Thanks for coming, everybody. I've been looking forward to this. First thing, how many of you are on Twitter? Okay. Live tweeting is encouraged. You can find me there at Alongside Wild. And I always say this in front of all my talks because now if I see you on the phone or a computer, I'm just going to be imagining you're tweeting about how much fun you're having and what you're learning. A couple disclaimers. I don't have any formal training in science communication or outreach, just a lot of lessons learned along the way. So just kind of keep that in mind and take things, what I say, with a grain of salt. First lesson is to always keep your audience in mind. And most of what I do is outreach to the general public. And this is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but based on many of my interactions with the general public, this is what I perceive them to be. So what am I doing here? I started doing science communication and outreach with a newspaper column. It showed up in about 4 newspapers throughout the Southeast, and I wasn't getting a lot of feedback. I was writing these things every month and then just basically sending them off into the ether. Never got any input or anything like that, so I said, let's forget that, and I started a blog. I started about 6 years ago, and at first there were 10 views a day. Half of them were me. It wasn't really too rewarding. But over lots of time, over years, the audience picked up. I get about 3,000 hits a day and well over 4 million overall. So I've been really pleased with that. And I blog about natural history, science as a way of thinking, and I also tackle wildlife myths. I've really been happy with that. I use Twitter a lot. I'm going to be talking about it a little bit more later, so I'll just introduce it now. In response to some of the discussion at the end of the last conversation, the analogy that I like is that you should not be thinking about it as a water fountain, but think about it as a fire hose, and you can't get everything from it. Just pop in every once in a while, and that's how a lot of people are using it as well. It's not like an email where you're bothering somebody and it's sitting there. People are coming in and out, and you're really not going to overload them or saturate them too much. I'm also on Facebook. I have a scientist page, and all I really do there is post links. These are the 3 places where I've decided to dedicate my energy. We've already learned this morning there's a lot more platforms, but I think you can really spread yourself too thin. I prefer to focus on 2 or 3 and then just put all my energy and my time into those. I want to talk a little bit about 2 what I call outreach myths. And sometimes, considering the time that I've spent doing science communication outreach, I think a lot of people are surprised when they hear me say a myth is that you should do it. If you're not already interested in science communication and doing outreach, you're probably not going to be inspired to put in the time necessary to be successful at it. And in addition, there's a lot of people encouraging folks to just get on there, start doing it, and I think that kind of minimizes the time. You wouldn't tell somebody that's been studying science communication their whole life, been studying journalism their whole life, hey, just do a little research. It's going to be good. You should do it. There's more to it than that. In addition, I think a lot of tenure and promotion committees or search committees, they haven't necessarily caught on to the idea that this is something that you should be spending your time doing. So I don't want to tell you to be a martyr. However, if you are interested in doing science communication, then I think you should just do it. Okay, the second myth, just do it. When people tell you to just start tweeting, I think it kind of sets unrealistic expectations. Some people might feel like they're going to sign on to Twitter, take a few moments crafting the perfect tweet, hit send, and then all across the country, this is going to be the scene. And it's just not the case. It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of energy, thought to build that audience. Not only people have to know you're out there, they have to know when you put something new, and that takes a lot of time. And I'm not trying to discourage you from doing science communication, but I just want you to have realistic expectations. It's going to take time to get that positive feedback that you may want and need. It's kind of a cliche, but you should be thinking about what your goal is and who is your audience. Those folks that are telling you to do science communication, they're going to be telling you it's good for networking. It's good for staying up to date on the latest research papers. It's good for networking, and those things are all true. But depending on what your goal is, it's going to affect how you use those platforms. If you're just talking to other scientists about the latest research paper, that's fine. But it's not going to be appealing to the general public. You're not going to be reaching those people with outreach. And outreach is why I'm doing it. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about today, just kind of case studies, maybe give you some examples of things you can apply in your field. So my goal is to expand the audience, reach people that aren't usually talking about science and natural history. And when you do that, you're going to be encountering people that come at this from a totally different angle, and you have to be ready for that. So I want to post a few examples of comments that I've received on my blog where I'm talking about snakes and wildlife and things like that. Why don't you fight abortion or something worthwhile instead of wasting your time here? Save a child, kill a snake? That's what I did. Yikes, right? Not something that I really anticipated getting into, and I didn't get into it. I try to take comments like this as a positive sign that you're reaching outside of the echo chamber. And for every negative comment that you get or controversial comment, you're getting a lot of people that are silently reading and learning. So I try to take this, try to put a positive spin on this. And I don't get into the weeds debating things like this. I might say something like, you know, it's important. The world has lots of problems, and it's important to, it's possible to focus on more than one at a time, and don't really get into the weeds on this kind of thing.
So don't write what you really want to say.
So I have a philosophy, don't hate, educate. And it comes up a lot when I'm dealing with people that kill snakes. And if the goal is to change people's minds, you're not going to accomplish anything by hating on them or making fun of them or calling them whatever. Just kind of neutral, impartial, and do whatever you need to do offline to vent and, you know, punch the wall or whatever. You know, dumbass, there are other idiots that worship rodents and insects just like you worship snakes. BTW, poisonous snakes kill. That's not a myth, bozo. trolls are people that are just there to pick a fight, get a reaction. And a lot of people will tell you not to feed the trolls. And I don't really get into it too much because they're lost causes. Again, they're just trying to get a reaction out of you. But there's other people reading those exchanges, and so that's who I talk to. So I do feed the trolls, so to speak. I don't remember what I said to this person, probably. But even you can even learn from trolls. I talk a lot about how the largest rattlesnake in the world was 8 feet long. And there's this urban myth going around that 10, 12, even 15-foot long rattlesnakes are, it's not even a big deal. See them all the time, no problem. And when I talk about how it's not possible, I got a lot of feedback saying, well, you know, we learn new things about the world all the time. Just because you haven't seen it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And it's kind of silly, right? But it does highlight that we as scientists think about the world a little bit differently. We can talk about what there's evidence for, and we can talk about things that are consistent with that evidence and things that aren't. And if you're going to say something exists that's inconsistent with that evidence, you need to come bring something to the table other than, I saw it, bozo. So I started a frequently asked questions page, and I covered some of those things, and it's really cut down on some of those types of comments. Anti-intellectualism is a real thing. Just ask Mark Campbell. Professors' opinions are not based on truth or actual events. Okay, fair enough, right? So this was one of the cases where I took the opportunity to talk about how I come to the conclusions I do. This is as a scientist, this is how I'm thinking about things. And if you say, well, I say this because of my values or my philosophy, or I say this because of the evidence, and you outline the way that you came to that conclusion, there really isn't that much that people can complain about. Once you start reaching large audiences, you really get, the message becomes clear that you're not going to reach everybody, and not everybody agrees with you. You know, you can't please everybody at the same time, basically. On my blog, I do a lot of snake identification. People are emailing me all the time, can you ID this? And so I turn them into blog posts, and I put it out to the crowd so we can talk through how I ID these animals. And it's really popular. It's great, but not universally. It could have been helpful, but instead chose to masturbate your ego by touting your superior knowledge of snake identification. Don't you just want to just punch this guy? Every once in a while, somebody's up in the line. I just blacklisted this guy, so he can't comment anymore. There's nothing worthwhile there. And then he emailed me, I want to know why you blocked me, and I told him. So you're not going to reach everybody. Okay, so the blog has become a really, really important platform for me, and I use it to kind of counter some of the sensational stuff that you're going to hear in the media. Slate Magazine, if you're familiar with that site, a few years ago they wrote an article about how green anacondas had invaded Florida. And I didn't like that article at all. There were a lot of inaccuracies. There's really no evidence that green anacondas are taking over. Their primary source were the curators of the Skunk Ape Museum in Florida. And they didn't say that in the article. And you know, just because they're believers of skunk ape doesn't mean we can discredit everything they say, but it does suggest their criteria for evidence is a little different than ours. So I wrote a blog post talking about that. It was pretty popular. I emailed it to the editor of Slate. She was really receptive, and she said, if you want to write anything for us, please let me know. So I took them up on that, and I think I tried to counter some of the base assumptions that really weren't tackled in that first article. I said, this is what exotic means, this is what established, this is what invasive means, and here's how scientists differentiate between the two, using reptiles as a case study. And so you're able to really reach a larger audience there. By the way, the person that wrote the original article never published another thing on Slate again, which I felt kind of bad about, but it really wasn't that good of an article, and there are a few other ones as well. So that started a relationship with the editor of Slate, and I've pitched a few other articles and shown up there, really expanding the audience. Okay, so it's not just people that are know you or coming to you. This is you're able to take advantage of their framework and network. Anyone remember the Eaten Alive special a few years ago? Speaking of anacondas, so this was a few years ago on Discovery. This dude wanted to go to South America, find a giant anaconda of legend, and for some reason get eaten by it, and alive. And this is kind of silly, and it just kind of feeds into the negative portrayal of snakes in the media. So I really wanted to take advantage of all this hype that Discovery Channel was promoting, and kind of piggyback off that and get the opportunity to talk about snakes, whether it's really dangerous, you know, and all that. And I was really pleased, and so I'm tweeting about it. I used the hashtag that they're promoting, just kind of took advantage of that. I also tweeted to journalists, hey, if you want to take a different tack at some of these, at this issue, please let me know. And they really took me up on it. Earth Touch Network, man getting eaten alive by anaconda is an education, kind of countering the sensational stuff. And I was interviewed in all of these articles. This is dumb. Here's a good one. I'll just let you read that one. This isn't just about masturbating my ego. This is also about changing the narrative, getting a perspective in there about snake conservation and realistic stuff. And so I was tweeting about it a lot. I was live tweeting along with the show using their hashtag. And you just never know who's watching. Vox Media was taking my tweets and putting them on video clips of Eaten Alive. And then they made this professional little thing. I had no idea about it, but that was pretty cool. And you can see almost 800,000 people had viewed it. And, you know, is this changing the world? No. But it has helped changing the narrative and getting your perspective out there. So in this case, what I did was piggyback off of an existing framework for science communication. This was already in the news. And the other strategy you can do is make your own news. And a few years ago, I was helping a colleague trap some turtles in South Alabama. It was in the Mobile Bay, which has fluctuating water levels, they're tidally influenced. And every once in a while, the water levels come up above your trap and drown turtles in there. And that's what happened when we checked the traps this one day. And I know in the past that researchers had tried CPR and mouth-to-mouth on turtles successfully. And so I wanted to give it a shot. But what I did differently, as I said, film this. So that's what we did. And I took the video and I condensed it into a two-minute clip of the highlights and just started tweeting about it. And people just eat this up. So fast-thinking biologist saves drowning turtle with mouth-to-mouth. This guy did this. National Geographic interviewed me. And then I also had the opportunity to write about this on Slate again. And, you know, you take the thing that grabs people, mouth-to-mouth on a turtle, and use that opportunity to talk about why are we trapping turtles? Why is it important to know how they're doing? This is a rare species. this is why monitoring and all these studies are vital. So it kind of used it as a jumping off point. And speaking of reaching beyond the typical audience, you know, I'm talking about wildlife conservation. Fox News probably isn't what you generally think of as the viewership. That always agrees with me, but they were interested. Gretchen Carlson, her PA, emailed me, wanted to know if they could use this video on The Real Story with Gretchen Carlson. I was like, yeah, sure. But it's not just about transient people interested. I said, you could use it, but put my name, put my Twitter handle, put my blog address up there. And that's what they did. Right before something about transgender people and how that's a problem. But, you know, again, lots of different viewpoints out there. So, for Eaten Alive, I piggybacked off an existing hype machine that Discovery was doing. For the turtle thing, I kind of created my own news. And the other case study I want to talk about was kind of a hybrid of the two. South Florida has a lot of invasive species. It's a really cool area, but it's just been taken over, particularly by things like Burmese pythons. You've probably seen them in the news. They're everywhere, and they're a real conservation concern. A bunch of researchers did road cruising, basically just driving around counting the animals they saw in Everglades National Park. And over 30 years or so, the number of pythons skyrocketed and all the mammals basically vanished. And that was correlation. But then they did a follow-up study. They put radio transmitters on rabbits and released them in areas with pythons and released areas without them. And virtually all of the rabbits in the python area were eaten. And imagine if rabbits aren't reproducing enough to counter this predation event, then nothing else probably is either. So this became a real problem. But the question is, what do you do about it? It's hard to just go out. Thousands have been removed of these Burmese pythons, but you can't just go out and manage for them, remove them. But what Florida tried to do instead is create this educational event called the Python Challenge, where you invite people from all over the country to go down into South Florida and catch pythons. And this was pretty cool. You know, I catch snakes in my spare time. Don't necessarily often get an opportunity to do it in a competitive setting. So I called my buddies up, and I was like, yeah, let's do this. And again, I felt like I could really help them with the educational component. So I said, I'm going to participate in this challenge. I put out a call on Twitter, who wants to join my team? And we got a guy from Atlanta to join us. He ended up being a producer at the Weather Channel. So there's that angle there. I said, I'm going to live tweet it. I'm going to catch pythons, live tweet it. And people were just eating this up. And probably because when you think of people that are going to be waiting around the swamp in the Everglades catching snakes, you don't necessarily think of these PhD herpetologists. And so it was a neat angle for people. We got one, fortunately. There was a lot of pressure because every day we were followed by at least one freelance journalist. The last 2 days, five people from Auburn flew down, and they were videoing us, so there was a lot of pressure. So fortunately, we did get one. And again, this isn't all about snakes are scary, and we need to fear them, and you get your voice out there and say, yeah, invasive species are a problem. This is why we're interested in removing them, but native snakes are cool. It helps you kind of control the narrative there. Lots of attention. This was a profile in Vice News. And again, it's not just about getting your name out there, it's about changing the narrative. And also looks good to employers when you're getting their institution out there. There were tons of, like I said, tons of media following us. The coolest one was probably this profile in Popular Science and really useful for changing the narrative. Okay, so I've already mentioned a few times that I really like Twitter, and it's got a bad reputation, I think. And I think it's because people associated with kind of mundane observations of life, and that's not what my experience is. You know, I follow journalists and scientists, and the people that are following me are different, and they're interested in whatever I'm talking about. And you never know who's listening to you. You know, Melissa Brock from NPR, she was following me. Dan Ash, director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. These are influential people that are listening to what you have to say for some reason. And then you can get them from all walks of life. Lennox Lewis, former heavyweight champion of the world. Jeff Corwin, who is that animal show guy, you may remember him. Mark Jurczyk, he's the CEO of the Nature Conservancy. So when you're tweeting out there, people are listening. And I like Twitter because it doesn't rely on this passive, you know, approach to gaining your audience. You can really find people that are looking for help. You know, I think it was a few years ago, 83% of the U.S. couldn't name a living scientist, and those that did named Stephen Hawking. And that indicates not only do they not know any scientists, but they don't really know who to ask. So it's too much to ask of them, find a scientist, and then ask your question. Sometimes you have to make yourself known. TweetDeck is an app associated with Twitter, similar to Hootsuite. This is the one I use. And what I do is I set up these alerts, basically. It says, if somebody says, what kind of snake is this, it pops up on the screen. Somebody says something about a copperhead or a cottonmouth. These are really commonly misidentified snakes. It comes up there, and I can talk to them. When people are asking about what the snake they found in their yard is, they're really thrilled beyond belief when a snake expert responds to them. Kind of a mixed reception when I correct people's IDs on the other things, but again, you just got to roll with it. Overall, really positive response, and again, you never know who's watching. This is Slate again. They really liked what I was doing, so they wrote this article, The Best Biologist on Twitter. And this has been a really kind of a game changer for me. I've spent 10, 15 years preparing for an academic career. But when I give a talk, even on my research, they don't talk about papers I've published. They're saying, look, this is the best biologist on Twitter. Even the dean of my university, when he introduces me, this is what he was focusing on. So it kind of gives a little bit of vindication, a little bit of credibility to science communication efforts when these things happen. Because again, not everybody, I think, is on board yet. The other benefit was that immediately there were 1,000 new followers because of this article. And when corporations do a targeted campaigns to gain followers, they'll pay $3-4 each. So it really kind of hammers home how you can build this valuable resource for science communication and outreach. I partnered with a graphics design company to generate these graphics to accompany the tweets when I answer questions. I created the hashtag not a copperhead, not a cottonmouth, just because it became so common that these animals were misidentified. And this kind of adds this fun angle to some of the routine questions. And they have these trivia things, so I'll tweet these out here and there. So I really like partnering with these types of artists. I've been talking about myself a lot. I really don't want to give you the impression it's just me out there. There's this growing science community of wildlife professionals, the field I'm most interested in. And it's really encouraging. There's Anne Hilborn. She's a grad student at Virginia Tech. She does mostly Serengeti research on wildlife, tweets a lot about cheetahs, and then she got this profile in The Atlantic. I talked about a little bit about the hashtag not a copperhead. Well, Michelle LaRue, she studies mountain lions, and people are always sending her pictures of cats, you know, house cats, bobcats, everything from their backyard. So she started hashtag cougar or not, and every week she'll highlight a picture that people sent her, and then they'll talk about why it is or isn't a mountain lion. It usually isn't. Kind of similarly, Catherine Scott, she's a graduate student out of Canada, and she's a spider researcher. And so what she does is she responds to all the people that find spiders in the house and reassures them that it's not a brown recluse. That's her hashtag. So I hope you'll check those people out. They're really doing some exciting work on there. And there's a kind of a snowball effect. Once you become known for granting interviews or interacting with the media, you become the go-to person. And that results in, you know, fun stuff. I was on the Weather Channel talking about how animals are likely to respond to climate change and weather changes. And while I was there, we also talked about snakes, which is something I'm passionate about. So kind of a snowball effect. And now I can't necessarily respond to all the media requests I get, so I can use that opportunity to forward them to people that are just starting out in science communication and may not have the audience that I have. So it's been great in that way. We learned about metrics and analytics and views and things, and those are really important, but I don't find them necessarily too inspiring. That's not what keeps me going. And so some of the alternative metrics are just the feedback that I get. And you know, I spend a lot of time convincing people you don't necessarily need to kill that snake. And And it resonates with some folks. You know, I haven't murdered a snake since I've started following Alongside Wild. I've screamed and shrieked, but no death has occurred. So that's progress. As a former snake hater, I can say Alongside Wild has made a huge impact on my outlook towards snakes. Live and let live. That's great. You're getting the message out there. And again, this isn't about saving the world, but it is about changing an environmental ethic regarding the wildlife in their backyards. And they're paying it forward, too. A friend just told me he didn't shoot a 4-foot cottonmouth because of what I've shared with him, which I learned from you. So that's kind of rewarding. And again, you don't hear from everybody. Most people can't be bothered to let you know what they're doing. But if you're out there interacting with folks, you're making a difference. People are excited about seeing snakes. So excited to see a snake after following Alongside Wild for so long. Thanks for all you do. And that's great. And you never know how you're affecting people. This person changed their degree to wildlife ecology. You know, I hope you don't regret it, but I I'm glad you're inspired. So I'll end there, and thanks again for the opportunity to come here and listen. Is there time for questions?
Yeah, we've got time for questions if anybody has them.
So I'm an extension scientist working turf in the Northeast, and I have very specific behaviors I'd like people to change, you know, about how they tend to their landscapes, particularly urban landscapes. We started a Twitter handle. I have a personal one. We started a Twitter handle for our program that a lot of us can use. So maybe this is for everybody. I would love to hear everybody's thoughts on this. I have very specific behavior. I mean, I'm not just interested as you've sort of made it to the point where you are now influencing people. And you know, the questions about changing behavior aren't necessarily as critical when you get up to there, but I want people to, you know, reduce the rate of their fertilizer, change the way they water differently. Can any of you, you know, with you with a lot of exposure to science, can you speak to that? Should it be a person tweeting? Is it okay to have, I mean, you could have easily made it to Auburn Natural History Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Deliberately made it your own. So, what can you comment on that whole dilemma?
Yeah.
Especially about getting a specific behavior change, like not killing snakes, like got validation.
Sure. Yeah, I think that when you're tweeting as an institution, you kind of have to. It's more dangerous territory. I like speaking for myself, and again, it kind of touches on. I don't want you to kill a snake because. This is why, and you know, I don't want to necessarily represent Auburn University. Another topic that comes up a lot is feral cats, or house cats that are outside. They eat a lot of wildlife. It's a conservation concern. So I'll say things like, I would like you to keep your cat inside, and here's why. And they can either buy the argument or not. You know, you can't make somebody, but you can basically explain why you do it, and then it'll probably resonate. It was there.
This idea of I want to talk to you, I want you to be, you know, that's one of the biggest challenges with social and managing social is, if you mentioned how you had, you know, 2,000 followers and you didn't respond to any of them, you know, for most people, they stop following you if you don't respond when they have some sort of question or they want to have a dialogue or discussion. So, you know, some companies do it well from a customer service standpoint, but in terms of advocacy, people are much likely
Yeah, I'll add that interaction is really important. I can't respond personally to everything people, every tweet somebody sends to me, but I'll at least fave it or something so they know it was received. And exactly. You know, people assume that the trolls are the problem, but it's actually the super fans that are most annoying that are commenting on every single thing. That you say, and I've muted a few of them. Don't tell them, but yeah, I do try and engage with them.
All right. Good. Thank you again, Dave.
Okay. Thank you.